Welcome to The Colorcast, a show about color grading, color science, and post-production. We are the Coloristos. I'm Jason Myris, a colorist and post-production engineer in Los Angeles.
And I'm Juan Salvo, a colorist and online editor in New York City.
And I'm Josh Petock, a colorist in Los Angeles. And this week, we wanted to get a little bit off of the tech subject and go into a little bit of our backstory, the personal history behind each of the Coloristos, how we became colorists, because a question like this comes up often. How do you get started as a colorist? How do you learn the craft? How do you do your first job? So I thought it would be good for us all to talk about our backstories. And I don't even honestly know about most, either Jason or Juan's backstory, their full backstory. So it'll be interesting to hear myself too.
That's probably true. It all started when I was bitten by a radioactive spider. Yes. Led to a very awkward adolescence.
After that, I was getting over 100% scores on the color test. Yes.
10.4.
You know, I actually, I was actually an art student in school. I was art major. I went to Penn State University. I graduated right around 2000, I guess 1999. And so what happened with me is I was an art major, actually 3 credits away from a cinema minor. I have a lot of background in film and school and stuff like that. But then right around 2000 was, there was a lot of technology going on. The internet was booming and I moved to Atlanta. And I quickly got a job as sort of a systems engineer at a shop that put together Avids and Pro Tools rigs. And so from there, over the last, say, 10 years or so, you know, I was in a very technical world, but it was always peripheral to art. I was in a system engineering role for the last, let's say, 8 years. And then about 2 years ago, I sort of decided I wanted to take advantage of that art degree and move back toward color. And so essentially for me, what I've done is started doing grading, mostly through Resolve, actually, to be honest. Resolve and then recently Scratch now, where I've started doing projects with friends that I met who are directors and DPs and stuff like that, and then started building up a bay to the point now where 6 months ago, I went and quit my full-time job. I was a director of technology at a post integrator in Hollywood. The thing that's been kind of interesting is I'm transitioning to being a colorist a lot in the same way maybe other people who are starting in color are, but I've actually been in the business for 10 years. So it's interesting. There's two big angles. First of all, I have a technical background that allows all of the equipment and the technical things that a lot of people might struggle with to be pretty easy. I mean, there's still lots to learn. There's color science and things like that. So what that's allowed me to do is sort of accelerate things by mostly focusing on grading. You know, all the gear is pretty secondary. But one of the things that's interesting is I feel like I'm dealing with sort of the new world order of color, wherein you guys will be able to speak to how things have traditionally been. You know, I'm sort of on a path that might not include apprenticeship or some sort of, you know, mentor apprentice relationship with a senior colorist. I'm actually going it very much on my own. And then I find that a lot of my support comes from guys like you who are my peers who I ask for, you know, advice about things or, you know, help when I'm up against a wall. So
I think that's a pretty common path. Nowadays, at least.
Yeah, definitely.
Kind of doing color work. Yeah.
Did you guys have apprenticeships? I mean, like Juan, how did you get going? And I know that you have a really deep background. So were you ever lucky enough to have somebody overseeing you and then learning from them?
No, I mean, as a colorist, I think it was a function of necessity more than anything else. So when I started out, I went to film school and then started working at a TV station. I started working in news as an editor. And so that was like my entry kind of level job, which I guess would have been what you'd consider an apprenticeship. But what it did was it gave me access to all kinds of equipment and allowed me to learn, you know, really heavily learn Avid, learn online editing with AB roll, multiple decks, switchers, and learn keying and effects and graphics that way, the hard way by today's standards, before After Effects, before all those things. And actually I became focused in on that. And I started becoming an online editor for a couple of TV stations. And that quickly led to having to do things like color correction on, you know, hardware color correctors, video color correctors. So it was like basically like your lift gamma gain functions on these little Sony correctors where it was like an RGB knob for each, for black, gamma, and for gain. And so you'd have to like, you know, manually dial in. This is sort of like the video equivalent of like dialing in printer lights. You know, you'd manually dial in the RGB adjustments on these things in order to color correct images. And I actually did. I mean, it was a great training tool because it really helps you understand what the components are to a color in a video image. So that led to eventually leaving news and going into the commercial field and doing commercial spots. And I was focused mostly as an editor and less so as a colorist specifically, but always doing kind of color, doing graphics. And then eventually coming to New York and getting into the doc world and starting to online documentaries. And that's when I started really heavily doing color work because it was needed. Most projects at the time couldn't afford to go to Company 3 or go to Nice Shoes and finish in a Resolve suite. So you had to find other ways to do it. And so we bought into tools like Final Touch and also like the Colorista stuff and working within Final Cut or Avid and Symphony as well and DS. And then even the Color Warper tool and the old Smoke for SD projects. I used to use that. That was a great tool. And so that's where I kind of trained as a colorist. And I sort of, a lot of it was just experience, trial and error, and also dealing with, in that environment, dealing with specifically with mixed format documentaries, which is all kinds of source formats, all kinds of quality, all kinds of issues to kind of contend with, and having to learn through trial and error and through mistakes and through successes, what works and what doesn't. And
are you talking about your mistakes or the cameraman's mistakes?
Just
to be clear.
My mistakes and sometimes the camera. I mean, well, the cameraman's mistakes, your mistakes are always like very, there's a difference in reaction to the mistakes because my mistakes I always find like can be kind of embarrassing or kind of awkward, but they're always really productive learning experiences. Like to me, I kind of look forward to making a mistake because it means I'm going to learn something. You know, if I can recognize that mistake, that means I'm way more than halfway to figuring it out because I've recognized what the issue is. Whereas with other people's mistakes, it's always just kind of frustrating because then it's thrown on to you to fix it. And so that was kind of my training ground. And that, you know, was, I don't know, 7, 8, 9 years ago, I started doing those things and really, really focusing on color. So eventually I focused, I shifted away from doing offline editing and offline work and even graphics work and focused more and more on doing online and then now almost exclusively color. You know, that's been my trajectory.
And then Josh is, he makes a regular job out of fixing other people's mistakes.
Oh my God. Yes, I do. Yes, I do. Sometimes say my job is based on other people doing their jobs wrong. Right. Sometimes. How I started was I was actually living in San Jose during the dot-com boom. I went to school at San Jose State. I studied radio, TV, and film. So it was a concentration of all of those. So you had to do all different ends of those jobs. So you really got to intimately know all those different things. Splice film, we did linear and all that stuff too. But the big thing that I did while I was there was we started a multimedia lab and we had Adobe as sponsors and Apple. And so a lot of people donated material. And this was like right when Director and Flash and all that stuff was really, really coming up. So straight out of college, I started working at different ad agencies because there was a lot of web development and a lot of animation and stuff like that going on. So I jumped around between several agencies, and it was just great around that time. There was tons of money flowing into the town. And then the dot-com boom kind of stopped almost suddenly, and it turned into a ghost town. And everybody was out of work, and it was really depressing. So I'm originally from LA, so I kind of picked up the pieces, had a little bit of savings, and said, I'm moving back to LA, and I'm starting over with what I learned in college. So I started way back down at the bottom. I worked in a vault for about a year at a Modern Video Film, which is really big post facility out here, and there was maybe 12 to 14 people working in three different vaults, and I think at the time we were doing maybe Master and Commander or a movie like that, and they would say, I need tape 5, 6, 7, 3, 2, 7. You run over to the vault and pick up all the tapes, and it was an intense way to get back into it, the hardest I've ever worked, but it was good because I really got intimately involved in figuring out the workflows, seeing it from the bottom level all the way from the Telecine to the Flame and Inferno and all of that stuff. I got to see how that whole flow happens. And while I was working in the vault, I started being an assistant editor at night and on the weekends to kind of just get my name out there since I already knew Avid, I already knew Final Cut. So I started really freelancing out there, and soon I was able to leave the vault and just became an assistant editor full time. Mainly worked at PBS and worked on a lot of public TV shows and news shows, stuff like that. That's where I met who was my mentor, a guy named Alec Shivani, who was a finishing editor and a colorist. And he really started to show me the ropes of like how things are done, how things are finished, because we had such tight deadlines. We really had to work intimately together. So he really was instrumental in showing me the ropes and how things worked and best practices and just to have a good attitude in general. So I owe a lot to him giving me the first opportunity to learn this stuff. From there, documentary field of those shows really lended themselves to doing reality work. So I started doing a lot of reality shows. I think now I'm on my 60th reality show. So I've done a lot. Over the last 10, 12 years, I've seen a lot of things I guess I can't unsee. So I got really good with blurring. I got really good with figuring out how to do problems and how to match cameras. And I don't think I would have grown as much as the colorist that I am today if I hadn't had all of these problem shots where you just have to figure something out. You need to make something flow. You need to make it look presentable just to air. So all the problems are saved until the very end. And so I've just learned because of all the problems I've always had to deal with.
Yeah, I think there's two things that have helped that. And I'm sure, Josh, you found the same thing. One is just necessity, having to do it. And then the second thing is also deadline, having to do it
absolutely
quickly. And there's no better training ground for as a colorist, especially with a client session and just having to face all kinds of different problems than having to deal with those two things, you know, having to deal with a variety of issues and knowing how to approach them and also having to deal with them in a deadline. So you can't futz around with it too much and then go overboard. You need to know how to see the problem, understand what's causing it, and then how to fix it and do it very, very quickly. Because Josh, you're flying through those things, right? You're on a very tight deadline.
Very, yeah. I mean, you know, sometimes 45-minute show a day. You know, part of it is learning expectations too. You go, okay, well, I can give you this in this amount of time, but here's what we're going to have to go easy on. Here's the things that we're not going to be able to fix. As long as you can set those expectations ahead of time, you're okay. But all that comes from experience, knowing how long something's going to take, because you don't want to be there for 20, 22 hours over-promising on something either. So
it's triage. You know, you're looking at it and then diagnosing it and making a judgment call about what to do.
And yeah, that was one lesson I learned for sure, is don't commit to something that you have not seen yet. If somebody says, oh, this is easy, it should take you about, you know, a few hours to do, you have to look at it yourself before you make those judgments.
I know producer's always the best one to tell you how long something's going to take. Because they always know exactly what's entailed.
You know, just even it out.
Yeah, it should be good, right? Listen, this won't take you more than a half hour. Yeah. Like, you have no idea what it's going to take. You have no idea. What has been the value of those experiences, Josh? What lessons have you taken from your reality work? Do you find that you can apply it to when you do music videos? Do you find...
Yeah, I mean, the thing that is really carries over to all of these disciplines is you have to be highly, highly organized. You have to keep all of the tricks that you've learned and have them available at a moment's notice. You go to any facility, they have their box of tricks that they keep really held in their back pocket. So when somebody says, you know what, I want Technicolor look, boom, you can just do it. It's always good to just be able to apply that on the fly as you need it.
So are there any special techniques you use for those kinds of things?
Well, the cool thing is learning stuff like Resolve gives me ideas on how to do stuff for Symphony as well. So I keep what's essentially like a power grade folder on Symphony. So I have a bunch of effects and color effects and stuff like that that I can grab at a moment's notice. So I have that available at all times. I also keep all of my work designated by different phases. So if I have done a first color pass, second color pass, or the original, I have access to all that. So if a producer comes in and says, you know what, I don't think we used that shot, I can always pull up the old one and say, well, here's the time code of the original sequence that I got, and it looks to be correct. So those things have been invaluable to me. The one thing that I don't really get, though, working in reality, is too much of a supervised session, because we're in such a time crunch.
Sure.
We can basically just fix things as we go, or we can fix things at the very, very end that need to be fixed. But generally, I don't do supervised sessions?
Yeah, I think the supervised sessions are kind of a uniquely stressful environment because you're really on point. So like when I'm doing color work with established clients, they sort of, you develop a trust and a repertoire, and particularly with longer form stuff, they don't necessarily want to sit through every single minute of the grade. So they'll come in and kind of do, they'll let me know what's going on. We'll conform the project. We'll take a look at it, make sure everything's correct, or, you know, check everything. Then we'll go through and just find a few kind of reference shots, and we'll sort of figure out a look, play around a little bit, spend some time kind of just testing different things or trying different things or commenting on here's some shots that may be an issue. Let's see what we can do with these shots, and then kind of lock down a look. And then I'll send the client away. I'll be like, all right, we'll see you in a day or whatever. And then, go through and kind of make that happen through the whole thing, come back and do a review pass and just sort of review and adjust and make tweaks as necessary. And then usually you're done with things like, especially with short form stuff, like with music videos, with commercials, it tends to be a situation where you're grading with the client in the room because you've only got X number of hours to do it anyways. And so you're just kind of expected to sort of immediately do things. And so there's certain things that are inevitably going to take time. If you're doing some rotoscoping work or you're doing very careful qualification, that's going to take a little bit of time no matter what. Like there's no direct shortcut for those things. You know, you can have kind of presets that get you close, but you're still going to kind of finesse and fine tune. And so with those things, I think having good client skills helps a lot. You know, having a good repertoire with a client, having the ability to sort of manage your client's expectations or manage your client's time in a way that's productive is good. So like I always say, like, do you want to go grab some water or something? Or maybe you wanted to make that phone call. Now's probably a good time. I need a couple minutes on this or whatever. That kind of will help the session sort of move along and stop somebody from feeling like it's going really slowly or this is a particularly awkward moment. And then there's other times where it just flies. You know, you're just going through and applying presets to shots and it's just like, oh, that's great. Boom, next shot. And you're flying through it.
Yeah. I mean, at some point you kind of have to be an entertainer at the same time, you know, talking and working at the same time. And so how's it going and what's going on? And you have to have a certain personality, I think, to do supervised sessions as well.
One of the things that's interesting is if you have a session with a client, the big thing I try to remember is that I love color. And while they may like it, they might not love it as much as I do. So I try to make sure that, you know, keeping things light and flowing and not getting overly bogged down or into anything that might become a project really quickly really helps, because the client's perception of a good color session isn't just whether it looks good or not. It's whether they feel like you're getting things done. They really want productivity, especially, you know, at some of the higher level stuff where it's going to be, you know, the clock is ticking. You know, sometimes a project might be, you know, not based like that. You know, you might be doing something for a set rate or whatever. But if you're in a higher end situation, it's an hourly rate. The client is going to want something for their hundreds of dollars an hour, let's say. And that's progression forward toward a final result.
That's, that's absolutely true. I mean, it is a different when you're billing by the hour and what you're being paid for is efficiency. You're being paid for your knowledge. You're being paid for your expertise, and you're also being paid for doing it quickly.
Yeah,
there's that whole what's that three way? You have three choices. You can either have it fast, have it done well, or have it done
cheaply.
pick two.
Yeah.
And if you're doing a session, a supervised session at a facility, you've picked quality and
fast
speed. Yeah. and you've given up on cheap.
Yeah, exactly.
And I mean, that's the approach I try and take, is like, I don't try to underbill for things. I try not to flat rate projects, because I find when you're flat rating projects, you've sort of agreed to do it cheap and well, but not necessarily quickly. So yeah, they're going to take a lot of time, or you're going to cut corners in order to save time. I don't want to be in that situation where I'm finding myself having to fight against myself in order to make something fit a budget that I've set. So, and that's something that, you know, you learn from experience. It's like you make mistakes and you go, maybe I shouldn't work that way, right? So I choose to be in a situation where I'm working and the client is working, and we're all concerned first and foremost about the quality of what we're doing. Secondly, close second, about the time frame in which we're doing it. So we're trying to get it done quickly and get it done efficiently. But first and foremost is that it gets done well. And then thirdly is that it gets done cost effectively. So that's the sort of the lesser concern.
One trap that I actually fell into early in my career is, as a colorist, you figure the more work that I'm putting into this, the more I'm grading it, the more I'm giving them more value, but that's not necessarily the case. That was always, a hard lesson I had to learn was don't overgrade something. Don't just do stuff because you can, unless the client is asking you to, of course, but that's kind of a hard lesson sometimes to learn because you just want to do a good job. You want to give them the biggest value for their money, but sometimes a very subtle move is the way you want to go.
Yeah, I see this. I think this is a symptom of you see this in a lot of some of the tutorials that are online that for Resolve, where it's a very simple look that they're doing in 18 nodes. And you're wondering why you could do that in one node or two nodes. Why are you don't need 18 nodes for this. And it's just literally, it's just doing things in a way that is not really efficient and it's overthought. And a lot of the times it's better. And this is something you learn with experience too, I think, is there's always more than one way of doing something. You know, there's things like, Josh, you probably find this, there's things you could do with a bunch of qualifiers that you actually end up doing with a little bit of a curve adjustment, right? I do that all the time. And so I'm like, I'll watch somebody else work and they're doing one qualifier for this one particular shade of blue and then another one for this little off shade of magenta. And then they're combining the two and they're doing this mixing mode. And I'm like, dude, you could just, here, look, you just took a tweak hue versus hue and you're done. That's all you had to do. It was done.
That's true. I mean, that comes from your experience too, though. That's right. The big thing. That's really what you're drawing
experience
on.
Is what gives you the fastest, path between A and B. And, the person with 18 nodes hasn't yet refined that down. I actually, what's funny is that my mom is a former newspaper editor, and she has a saying on her wall. It says, "Pardon me, sir, for this long letter, for I have not the time to write you a short one." and it's basically, 18 nodes is a long letter saying, what could be done by an experienced person in a sentence or two. So,
or have you heard this one? The best programmer is a lazy programmer.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Somebody who doesn't want to write 100,000 lines when they could only write 10,000 lines,
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. One thing I run into a lot, and I'd love to hear what you guys do, is so how many of you have run into the situation that a person promises a project on a given day and then, actually delivers it several days later, but the deadline hasn't necessarily changed, or there's an assumption that it can still be squeezed in? I guess, what's your take on the diplomacy required for things that literally become almost impossible to pull off in the amount of time you've actually been given? Have you guys run into that?
It's sort of rhetorical. Yeah, we all being at the end of the line, you always run into that, but it comes from just setting the expectations too, and hopefully the person that's working with you, you're working as a team. You go, look, this is how much time I need, this is what it's going to take, this is how many hours I'm going to need, so I can give you this. If I have this amount of time, I have that, you can have this. If I have this amount of time. So as long as the expectations are set and everybody is honest, then that's fine. Or if they say, look, we want you to work 22 hours straight to do this, but you say, you know what, it's going to take a little OT for that. So you have to be,
or a lot
since
of
it
OT.
Took so long. Yeah, since it took so long for you to get this to me, you're gonna have to pay a penalty for it.
I say I have two techniques for dealing with this. One is, and I hope my clients aren't listening, but one is I do fudge my time estimate a little bit to give a little bit of, because they're inevitably, you're gonna have some delays. That's just always gonna happen. So you have to factor that delay into how long you think something's gonna take. So if they need it by Friday, and you're like, well, you realistically could do it from Wednesday, I always say I need it by Tuesday. Just to have that. So if on Tuesday they miss their deadline, or they miss the deadline by 6 hours or whatever, then I still have a little give.
Yeah.
That's one thing. And then the other thing is, and this is harder to do, but it's important, is to have a kill fee if they don't, provide enough notice, or have a penalty. Like, they're wasting your time. You have this incident from have incidents like this from time to time with clients where you're like, you try to be accommodating and they kind of take advantage of that a little bit. And it's like, it messes up your schedule. It messes up all the other projects you have lined up, because you're not working on just one project. No, none of us are. We're all juggling multiple things. And so it messes up everything else if your schedule gets thrown off by this one project. And delays happen. And sometimes people can't lock. And this happens to us. It happens across the board. I had one incident where I was like grading a show, and this was years and years ago. I was grading a show and I had finished the show and I was trying to output it and it kept crashing. And this was back before there were any really good compressed HD formats. So this was an HD show, but it was uncompressed HD. Off drives that like today I would laugh at. It was like a couple of Apple X-ray racks. And so it kept dropping frames. And, you know, I've run into this issue before. It was like a render was bad or something. So I'd re-render it, re-export it, move it around or whatever. Finally, it turned out something was physically wrong with one of the drives. And so eventually the volume failed and the volume just died while I was outputting with all my renders on the volume. And this was on a show that was due on Monday. And this was Friday night as I was like finishing it up and outputting it. The volume died with all of my work. So I stayed up straight through from that Friday night. I didn't go home Saturday. I stayed through Saturday night into Sunday, recapturing the whole show from tape, reapplying all my grades, remastering it, and then finally getting it back out basically Monday afternoon, making FedEx and making my deadline. But of course, I mean, that wasn't time I could really build a client for. That was like my own issues. But that's what it takes to go the extra mile and get it done. When we all run into issues, and the question is just, do you inconvenience someone else because of your issues, or do you find a way to make it work no matter what? And so a lot of times clients choose to just inconvenience us rather than finding a way to make it work. You try and be accommodating because we all understand there's issues and you run into walls and you run into problems. I try to be accommodating, but there's a certain point where it's like, you know, accommodating can only get you so far. And, it's really kind of a disrespectful thing to just sort of walk over my time. Like my time is not any less valuable than your time.
Knowing when to sort of put your foot down at those moments when, you know, accommodation has gone too far, you know, because I really think that, you know, it's a challenge. You have to really play a chess match, not only with your schedule, but also with, you know, various clients that you meet. If you're lucky enough, you have clients that are, you know, very much on your side and, you know, want the experience for everyone to be good. But then there are other clients who are more aggressive. You know, it's kind of, you know, give an inch, take a mile. There are clients that will put you out of business if you let them. And so for your own sake, you have to remember that a certain moment will arrive when you have to say, you know, look, I've done everything professionally possible. I understand that it took you forever to get this approved or whatever. And, you know, now you're asking me on the evening before it's due to say color grade, you know, your hour documentary. And it's not possible. And so it's really important that you don't let yourself get run over. And that's where the diplomacy comes in. How do you tell the client no more or politically make things adjustable so that you can get it done in a reasonable amount of time without running yourself into the floor or over budget or whatever. So
one technique that I've really learned how to do well is get things before they're done and finish them in less time. One tool that I have is just the conforming Avid. It's a lot easier, but being able to do that and get a head start on all your grades and get really what somebody is doing at that when they're trying to lock something down is they're working on the last 5% of it. So why can't I work on the other 95% of it while you're trying to get your work done? And then you do a conform and you know you only have to do 5% of the work. So sometimes it's not only being assertive about it, but being proactive and saying, where are you at with this? What's going to change? Are you only, like for me, are you only working in Act 3? Then I can work on Acts 1, 2, 4, and 5 instead. So I'll stay out of that. And your clients will appreciate that too. They'll say, oh, well, you're helping us hit our deadline and it's good quality and we can both work at the same time. Strategies like that work really well, and I think your clients will also appreciate it.
That's a good strategy if you're working in-house and you're kind of you're in a shared media environment, like with the Unity and or ISIS or whatever it's called now. But it becomes a little bit more troublesome when it's like one of those things where it's coming out from out of house, where it's supposed to be a locked project and you're just kind of mastering it.
That's what I deal with too, is people will say it's available on Monday and then it'll be Thursday and they want it by Saturday, you know, like that kind of push with the approval or the picture lock or whatever. So
one other thing that's sort of like from the colorist perspective, as opposed to the client perspective, that's kind of a problem with these sorts of delayed projects or last minute things is when you're shortchanging the amount of time you have, that shortchanges the quality of your work as well. So it makes your work worse. It's not just that the client's product is worse and that the client's product suffers, but your own work suffers. And it never looks good to have bad work out there from you. You know what I mean? Like I'd hate to see something I did that I wasn't proud of that I had to do because I didn't have enough time, or they delayed too much, or the project didn't get to me late. There's a lot of excuses, but ultimately it just doesn't look good.
Yeah. I mean, I try not to be too critical of other people's work when I see it, because in the back of my mind, I go, oh, well, maybe they only had 3 hours to work on this. Maybe they had other issues. Maybe it got handed between person to person. Or maybe the client said, I want it that way. So it's really tough, especially when your name is on it as well. But, you know, one interesting thing, too, is in these supervised sessions, they're paying for the session, right? Sometimes it can be difficult to just say, no, we're not doing that. No, that's not the direction we're going. No, we're going to do something else. Curious to hear what you guys have to say about that as well.
One of the things that I've attempted to do, especially as a person starting like a small boutique operation, is just, you know, how can I say yes as much as possible? Yeah. And so one of the things that maybe you guys have these in your pockets, and I would say that I'm developing kind of like you said, Josh and Juan, I'm developing what I'll call a bag of tricks. So I'm trying to sort of take note and inventory what it is that people really would like often, you know, and invest in those things. So for instance, I find people would really like to be able to take a look at things remotely. So I figured out a solution where they don't necessarily have to come in for every change. That's something that people really enjoy because it helps with the flexibility of their schedules. Another one is DCPs, for instance. People are saying, you know, I have no idea about this, and I have called a couple places and it's really expensive. Can you solve that? And so, I've put a lot of effort into that. So what I would say is that gets down to a smaller level too, when people say, oh, I'd like an ethereal Technicolor effect, or, you know, I'd like the highlights slightly blurred. And then you have things available for those. So overall, you know, I'd say the bag of tricks is a big deal. And then focusing on things that people want the most will really help you a lot, because you just have those things prepared ahead of time.
I think, Josh, to kind of go back to your point about what if the client doesn't want something, you don't want, or want something that you don't think is very good. I think that's a big part of that. That to me is probably the most important and the least teachable skill that's required for a colorist, is the psychology and the client management side of it. That's not so easy to kind of, you can't pick it up from a book so easily. But I find that in instances like that, I always like to show the client something I like, or subtly shift the conversation onto favorable terrain. So, you know, for the kind of the laughable, or it's become almost a joke, but the example now is like people looking at the Log-C proxies or the Log-C version of a edit all through the offline, and then coming in and going, oh, I really like the look of the offline. And if when you get that LUT on there and you start bringing the contrast back, they're like, oh, it's so contrasty. One part they like is sort of the softer black. So we start lifting, kind of subtly lifting the blacks, but not in a way that reduces overall contrast, just takes the edge off the very bottom of the blacks. And that kind of creates that effect, but still retains a lot of the contrast. Or, you know, bringing back a little bit of the saturation at a time, a little bit back of the saturation at a time, and sort of easing the client into a more of a normal look, so that by the end of the session, you've kind of really gotten them away from seeing the offline and seeing the actual, what the image should look like, or something closer to what the image should look like.
Yeah, I think when you're dealing with a situation where you really disagree with a client, one of the things that you can often do is, a lot of times people will say, when you want to influence someone, you can't get it in the first sort of request, so to speak. You have to plant the seed. So the way you can do that as a colorist is start showing them versions of things. And if you're in a situation where you're able to beforehand, you know, put together ideas, and, you know, with the idea that you have some looks based on their footage, something that actually applies to their project, or, you know, maybe stuff for other examples. But usually if you're dealing with a client, you're dealing with their footage. But what I'd say, if there's a way that you can version things, you know, somewhat quickly, and this is actually why Scratch is really nice. You can version in Resolve, absolutely, and other applications too, but Scratch gives you the ability to version really quickly. When I get into a situation where I feel like the client is really out there, or not, you don't want to say out there, but it doesn't realize where it could go. I start creating versions really quickly, and all of a sudden what it does is, if they have their one version, let's say, they're very focused on that. But all of a sudden, if you can quickly create four other ideas, it dilutes their version a little bit and their value. And so they're not so clingy to it. If they do find another idea or two that looks good, they'll start letting go. And then what happens is, maybe not at that moment, you will get them to sort of move in the direction you feel is positive for the project, but you keep moving down the timeline, and then all of a sudden they say, you know what, that look you did back there might apply really well here, and all of a sudden they start opening up to your ideas. And once you get that initial moment where they start to say, where they still feel like they have creative ownership with your input, because that's what a lot of this is based on. They're worried. Worried about the idea that it's not their concept or idea, and you know, just they want to feel like they're it's their baby, you know. So anyway, if you're able to show them some ideas quietly, move them into place, show them where they can be applied, that helps. So
there is a subtle art of making it look like your idea was actually their idea. Which is really like a great, some people could do that really, really well too. So that's a good strategy.
And that's the experience too. I think that, you know, there's a ton of experience required for just grading in general, but yeah, definitely 50% of it is this idea of how do you interact with clients creatively? And, you know, especially with the fact that with a lot of film and TV projects, man, they have fought so long and hard, and you are coming in largely at the end of it. You haven't seen really, well, I'll say the blood that was shed at the script level, at the funding level, at the production level, at editorial, and here you are coming in and you're making all these ideas that are going to make an incredible change to the project and the look and idea. And you got to remember that as a colorist, that, you know, you're coming in late. If you're lucky, you might have been introduced early on, maybe as workflow or pipeline designer or whatever. But the big thing is that they have been through many battles before they get to you with color. And so it's not that the client necessarily doesn't like your ideas. It's just like this stuff is really baked in a lot by the time that they get to you, even if it's not up on screen yet, you know. And so softly integrate yourself into the process. Show them that you have good ideas and that you're not going to harm their original intent. You're just going to make their original intent as good as it can be. So
this is where one thing where kind of working on dailies or working on early on in the project in terms of color is really helpful, because you're kind of planting the seeds really early on, as opposed to trying to come in and change them at the end.
And you're able to go in and keep things like maybe one, the low contrast look from becoming a permanent fixture in editorial and stuff, maybe by giving it at least a basic look.
I would love it if every single Alexa Logsy shoot would just immediately make 709 dailies and not let the client see the Logsy stuff, because it would save a lot of headache.
Or just send them like an HD link with that LUT applied. Here you go. Just trust me. It'll be good.
Well, people do that. Like, they, you know, like the FSI monitors have like the Log-C LUT goes right into it. People are seeing it on set with the contrast, but then they look at it in the edit. They'll just take the ProRes files. Hey, it's ProRes. Let's just use it. And they'll take the ProRes files and then just work off that. And a lot of editorial systems, there isn't a really easy way to apply a LUT on input, you know? Avid has the, when you're dealing with like external QuickTime sources, you have that like set source module where you can set like the source levels, so you can
AMA, right?
Yeah. I mean, it would be great if they had like set a LUT onto it, you know, right off the top, so you could just LUT it on input and just work with it, LUT it in the timeline, and you never actually see the Log-C. We really have to get beyond living in a universe where there's multiple color spaces that are being used, and we really have to get beyond this kind of hassle in the editorial world where you're just having to kind of convert beforehand, or look at something that's not right, or convert in the editorial with like really clunky plugins that just don't work very well.
I mean, I think going back to your points too, Jason, is the client is paying a lot for trust as well. If it's somebody that they've worked with for many years, they go, you know what? Jason knows what I'm talking about when he says, when I say, do that thing with the thingies on the thing, and you go, yeah, I know exactly what you need. Then they know that you're going to do the right thing 100% of the time.
I'll say one thing. There's a little bit of a psychological thing that's kind of like the doctors wearing their, you know, lab coats. That comes with like having the full panels, which is, it's a little bit intimidating when you're like standing and operating this like heavy machinery. And so it creates a sense of like, oh, he must know what's right or what's not. It's like the same way you trust your doctor to understand what is medically.
A good analogy in post-production that's the same is when you go to a mix house. You look at a mix house, they have these huge mixing boards, and I have never seen them pull a pot or anything on any of those other boards. It's like the money LED lights. They could be completely blank on the inside. Nobody would know.
They even have motors. They slide up.
Yeah, down. Right.
I've seen them work like a couple of knobs at a time, but it's never like they're never like riding like 16 level, you know, mixer channels at once. Yeah.
Right.
I think there's a little bit of that in color. You know, having like walking into a color room, having a properly set up environment, having a client area, having a monitor that looks like, you know, this backlit and looks like it's kind of set up right in a way, makes a psychological difference, puts the client in the mindset of they're being taken care of. There's someone with some expertise at work here, and there's some reason to sort of trust their opinion.
Yeah, I actually think that you can't overstate that point enough, Juan. And actually, right now, you know, I'm dealing with that myself. You know, essentially, I've moved into a office over the last weekend. And what I would say is it's pretty incredible. I had this raw space and I'm looking at it and I'm like, how can I bring people here and have them, you know, trust me with their project just by how I set this room up, you know? And boy, let me tell you, that's quite a task. And then the thing that the point you're making about, say, the control panels or even the audio mixing console or the, let's say, the really nice facility that just sort of like has a professional mark on it in that it is not a sloppy place. There's a lot of thought put into a pro facility that really shines. And when a person walks into that and they're in that environment, they sort of, sometimes release themselves to the process. Right. They all of a sudden say, oh, wow, these people have been doing this longer than I have. I need to trust these people.
They have a freaking barista on staff here. It must be good.
Absolutely. You know, I mean, those things count. And I think you can take that to a point where there's very sort of diminishing returns. And one of the challenges nowadays is, you know, how far do you need to go with that? Because that's cost that's not related necessarily. Panels are directly related to project, but a barista is not, you know. Yeah. Now, a barista will get you a certain amount of, what is it, ethos or pathos? I can't remember. But basically, you know, believe me because I'm the professional, you know. And so the thing is that how do you convey professionalism without taking it to such a point where you're actually at like a luxury resort level and you're actually sort of wasting money? You know, my main point being that, yes, a professional environment will get you a lot of initial mileage. You do have to keep them, you know, there with your excellence. But I think one of the things that a lot of people are facing nowadays, especially as a lot of people are looking to freelancers or people who are at smaller shops, you know, let's say not corporations or not longtime businesses for some of this professional grading work, you know, how do you give yourself the best possible shot at getting some sort of trust and freedom developed with your client, you know, within your resources? Because you probably can't afford a barista, but that doesn't mean that you're not capable of doing an excellent job on their project. So that's an interesting new thing that we have to kind of navigate, you know.
I'll say one important thing to that, and one thing to factor in is, and there is a psychology to this, which is people do think, and I think it's sort of a truism that you get what you pay for. And so I think if you're pricing yourself as kind of a bargain solution, you're going to get a certain level of, it doesn't matter what your expertise is or what your experience is or what your capabilities are. There's going to be a certain level of scrutiny, additional scrutiny that you would get from someone versus pricing yourself more in line with what the market suggests is the proper price for a service. My father actually worked in like construction for a while. And so he would try different bid strategies when he was bidding on a job. And he always found that like if he went for the lowest bid, he would never get the job or almost never get the job. But if he went somewhere in the middle and then presenting himself as professional and capable, he would usually get the job. And the lowest bidder, you know, is usually kind of a bad sign. I think it's true in most fields.
Yeah. Well, I think pricing is really a big make or break point for a business, because not only is that allowing you to attempt to, you know, create a real livelihood. I mean, that's the set and forget point sort of on where you are able to actually reap benefit for your efforts. You know, you buy all this equipment, you put in all this training, you put in all this effort and time and energy on, say, a colorist career rather than an accountant or financial analyst career, you know, what I would say is that if you're going to go in and do grading, it's difficult in a sense because whereas, say, accounting is I did your tax return, you know, color has got a subjective component to it. I did a good job on your film, you know?
Well, I think the measure of that is how the client feels. The client has to feel like they walked away and you did a good job on their film, or they have to walk away and feel like their film looks really, really good.
Right.
And that's where that measure is. And it's not necessarily, you know, because there is, it's a very aesthetic measure. It's not like there is a technical measure, you know, is it legal for broadcast if you're doing a broadcast tape? Does the DCP play back? Was it at the right frame rate? Was it at the right frame? I mean, there's technical things that evaluate whether or not you're capable, but then ultimately whether you're good or not is determined by the aesthetic things,
right, which are
much more subjective and really have to do with what was your client's experience before your project, during your project, and then after your project was done. Mm-hmm. What was the reaction that your client saw?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think colorists actually have a unique ability to show a before and after. Here's what your picture looked before I did something with it, and here's what it looks like after. You can't really do that with an edit, per se. Like, sure, this is what the scene looked raw before I edited it, but we can always, you know, hit a button and say, here's before me, here's after me, and they go, whoa, you helped that out a lot, or now the lighting is different, or, you know, there's something else there, so.
Here's the thing about, though, is like, the before and after is not always such a good thing.
Right.
You know, you look at the really high-end colorists, they never show before and after in their reels, and the reason is that a good example of this was actually kind of a fluke. It was like somebody posted, it's on YouTube, I think Pat Inhofer's newsletter mentioned this. There's some cool behind-the-scenes stuff for Safe House where they showed the grading.
Panic Room, right.
Where they showed the
Nakamura.
No, they showed Nakamura grading. And you see like some of the before and afters. And a lot of it, it's like, you know, big improvement in the shot. And then some of it, he's taking like a lot of the contrast out. He's bringing the highlights down. And it's really becoming kind of a muddier picture, but it works thematically in the film. He's a brilliant colorist. No one would fault Nakamura, but if you're looking at a before and after of that shot, which they showed, which you don't usually see, you would not go like, that's an improvement. You would actually think, oh, there's something wrong there, but because you're seeing it completely out of context.
Yeah.
Right.
One of the things too, is just even where you start from. I think that probably more often than not, as you become more professional colorist or more experienced, probably you would get away from the, you know, proving yourself through the before and after. Like you said, a lot of guys at high level aren't doing that. But the other thing too, is there's a huge amount of debate among people who do want to do it, where you even start from. And we actually had a conversation about this on Lift Gamma Gain a bit. You know, do you start from the log C? Do you start from log C with like a LUT on it, you know, and all this stuff? And then it became this really sort of nonsensical situation where you're like, you know what? Oh, wait, probably shouldn't even, you know, do it at all, because half the time your clients aren't going to want people to see befores, you know, and a lot of DPs are sensitive about, you know, showing raw materials that they've shot, because, you know, everybody's worried about their perception in the marketplace. And if you're giving away certain things that they've done or not done, you know, that's going to upset them. So,
right. Well, speaking from somebody who does have a before and after reel, I find it to be actually really useful, because the stuff that I work with is so badly shot usually, and so it's like almost unrecoverable, that when you do show them a before and after, it's a huge difference. So, and a lot of the stuff too is that I found is I'll show my reel and they'll say, oh, we really like how you did this with this shot, and this, I love how you did this look or something like that. So it ends up, for me, it ends up being more of an educational tool to show you, okay, this is what's possible. This is what we can do with your badly shot footage as well.
Yeah. I do think with the doc work, in particular, there is a method to it, especially because with doc work, you're not doing stuff that's necessarily stylistic, mm-hmm, as much as you're just trying to fix issues and improve the overall perception of the quality of the image, as opposed to trying to create a look and create, you're not going to do kind of a low sat, you know, panic room look on a documentary. Usually you'll be doing kind of a more normalized look that just kind of like, you know, fixes crushing or fixes, you know, lifted blacks or whatever, you know, you're fixing this issue or that issue or white balance a lot. And so you want to kind of be able to show that you can do that.
I think Josh's point on the educational approach, the idea that you're attempting to show clients what you're capable of can happen really nicely in something that's not before and afters necessarily on a project. What you could go and do, and this is what I'm thinking doing, because there's a lot of services I'd like to offer that are based around a concept that the clients might not be familiar with, but they would really love and could use once they see it. So for instance, let's say I want to prove to people I could do some nice denoising of shots that were either, you know, underexposed or, you know, have some sort of problem with that. And so instead of going and necessarily just having an arbitrary before and after for a project, just take some really nice footage that has the problem you have and then quickly show them in a minute or two what you're able to do with it to make it nicer. And so then all of a sudden you'll get the credit, but it won't necessarily be the before and after of a project. And I think if you can demonstrate your capabilities in small snippets like that, especially on sort of more esoteric things like noise reduction or beauty work, your ability to make an actress look, you know, really beautiful, I think people appreciate that. And, you know, it's an in and out that can be really specific and succinct, whereas maybe it might be more difficult for people to hunt through a larger before and after for a whole project just to see where some beauty work is, you know.
Yeah, the only unfortunate thing about that is all good color work depends on good cinematography. When it gets down to it, it's like good, you can't do anything with a black shot. You can only do something with something that somebody shot that's beautiful. So sometimes if you didn't do that much to it, but it is an insanely beautifully shot, you're in my opinion, I think you're taking credit for the cinematographer's work.
But if that's true, Josh, then every A-list colorist is doing just that, because they all work with the best cinematographers and they all get the best footage, and then their reels look jaw-droppingly amazing. But it's not because they don't do anything, because they do. I mean, they contribute to the overall quality of the shot. And I think, you know, I think a lot of it has to do with client expectations. Clients know what usually, not always, clients usually know what the caliber of their footage is. They know whether they're dealing with something that's good or not.
Like, for instance, there was something floating around on the TIG for a while too, that was this guy who had won like colorist of the year or something like that, and it was in Europe, and he was like, look, all I did was really set the luminance levels on it. That was it. That's all I did. It was just beautiful footage to start with. So it's difficult to judge some of that stuff, I think, just because you just don't know. You don't know what you started with. You don't know. What I will say, though, is if you have an amazing cinematographer, you can produce some jaw-dropping color work too. So it's kind of, they're almost like mutually exclusive.
There's also a situation too that's interesting, and Josh, you can probably relate to this, and I actually have to deal with it a lot, is that there's two kinds of color grading. There's grading where you're attempting to take difficult material and get it to zero, get it really watchable, you know, and I guess, you know, in a certain extent, if you've got a run and gun, you know, reality or whatever, you're dealing with a lot of that. Then there's this idea of taking it further aesthetically with, you know, enhancements that, you know, help the story or help the shot, you know, do its job better. And boy, are they two totally different tasks. And it's odd. Recently I had to work with a project that needed a lot of help, and I spent the majority of my time making it viewable and usable. And very recently I have a red project that's come in, and it looks really gorgeous. And it's so funny because of the fact that I just come from a project that needs recovering. On my first watch through, literally I said to myself, and I'll admit this, I was like, wow, this doesn't need anything. I basically said to myself, I'm like, you know, there's nothing wrong with this. It was all shot really wonderfully. And then all of a sudden I started sort of putting on my creative hat. I'm like, okay, wait. I could really make this look cool if I did this. And it took about a day to shift gears, but man, was it a different, set of gears. I really had to take a look through it and put on that creative hat, because I wasn't in a recovery mode trying to save the project. So.
Yeah.
Yeah. Josh, I think you'll agree with this, that it's almost two different jobs.
Yeah.
It is. It can be.
And
yeah.
And the first task, the making everything look okay task, is really, it's the most difficult work.
Yeah.
It requires the most expertise, and it's the least recognized.
Absolutely.
That's totally true.
It's completely unappreciated. So.
Yeah.
The only thing
that I wanted to add to Jason's, though, is, and this is something I do encounter on my work a lot, is I can sometimes help the editors tell a better story with the work that I'm doing. For instance, if we have something where they go, we need the scene to take place at night. Can you do anything? Or we need to just make this interview take place at night. Or we have this scene and it was completely like a different camera, or it was GoPro or something else. We needed all to flow. Then I feel like I've helped them tell a better story.
Yeah, no, those are capabilities that are really nice to be able to offer as a colorist, you know, day for night. And if you need to make things look, say, old or vintage, or you need something to be cleaner than it was, you know, so.
Well, speaking of all that, I'm going to have to fix something right now. So we'll go ahead and wrap it all up. And I will say I am Josh Petok. I'm a colorist and fixer extraordinaire in Los Angeles. You can see me on Lift Gamma Gain or Twitter at Josh Petok.
And I'm Jason Myris, a colorist and post-production engineer in Los Angeles. I'm about to experience the joy of grading a really well-shot project where I won't have to fix much. You can catch me on Twitter at Jason Myris and also on Lift Gamma Gain on the forum there.
And I'm Juan Salvo. I'm a colorist and online editor in New York City. I'm about to do both things, fix and experience the joy of something beautiful. And I'm also going to answer Josh and Jason's and anybody else's questions on Lift Gamma Gain. And I'm also available on Twitter at J_Salvo. So that's it for this installment. We will catch you all again next time.